Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. And again, good morning. I'm a little short of sleep, so we have this thing going on right now where we have a lot of leftover colored paper from when we used to print a lot of flyers. So the instruction is try to use non-white paper. So I needed a little bit of extra stimulation this morning, so I brought this bright orange, and we'll see if that helps. I like it anyway. I even have cartoons on there. So I've been, most of you know, I've been working with this book, The Six Perfections by Dale Wright, and going through each one of these chapters. And today we're doing the last one, the sixth one. So the perfections are Dana, which is generosity, Sila, which is morality, Kshanti, which is patience or tolerance, Virya, which is energy and effort, Jhana, which is meditation, which is the last one we did, and this one today is Prajna, which is wisdom. So it is sort of the culmination of the perfections or the paramitas. So I'm going to be doing a fair amount of reading today. So, you know, the people in one of my prison groups just say, oh, cool, story time. So here we go. Wisdom is the heart of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition of thought and practice. In the mythology surrounding the tradition, wisdom is the mother of the Buddhas, since it is wisdom that gives birth to enlightenment, and it is wisdom that nourishes and sustains the bodhisattva's compassionate involvement in the world on behalf of all beings. So we sometimes say that we have wisdom and we have compassion, and those are two wings that are required in order for us to fly. And what they're saying here is that the two of them are completely intertwined and interdependent. The perfection of wisdom is pictured as more than just the highest and most exalted of the bodhisattva's virtues. It is the one that brings the others to fruition. The first five perfections are initially practiced at ordinary levels of understanding and then nurtured to the level of perfection when wisdom is applied to them. So all the way through, we have kind of been talking about each perfection and then talking about how wisdom affects it and how then that brings it up to another level. So what defines wisdom in Mahayana Buddhism? Although wisdom is understood more in terms of a certain comportment or behavior, a particular way of being in the world, than it is in doctrinal or conceptual views, ideas are nevertheless the essential starting point for the practices of wisdom. Therefore, the Heart Sutra, which we chanted this morning, the most compact version of wisdom sutras, begins by claiming that those who wish to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should view things in this way. The implication of this passage and many others like it is that there is a certain way to view the world that leads to wisdom. The view itself is not wisdom, because holding it as an intellectual position or belief does not necessarily make you wise. But they claim this is the point of view that will get you there. So what is this view? The view in question is shunyata, the Mahayana principle of emptiness. And he has the word emptiness in quotes all the way through here. It is a translation of this word shunyata, and you could argue that it's not a great translation, but we don't have a great translation. It's sort of the one that we use. We've alluded to emptiness at every stage of our reflection on the six perfections. Wisdom is the capacity to envision and work with the emptiness of all things. The bodhisattva dwells on the concept of emptiness, hoping eventually to embody its meaning at a more profound level than just conceptual. What emptiness means is best explained in terms of what it is that things are empty of. So all things are empty, the texts claim, insofar as they lack their own being. Own being is a technical term for the quality of being self-generated, self-possessed, the immortal self or the immutable nature of such a thing. Things in possession of their own being, things with self-nature, are not subject to conditions, influences, and change. They just are what they are without respect to other things or time. The central insight of emptiness, then, is that all things lack this characteristic. That is, nothing generates itself, nothing stands on its own, and nothing just is what it is forever. If nothing controls its own being in this way, then, in Buddhist terms, all things are empty. Claiming that all elements of existence are empty in this sense, Mahayana Buddhists took the word emptiness to name the character of reality overall. And we will be obviously talking a little bit more about this as we move along. He talks about sort of this sense of a negative feeling about the word emptiness. And he says, the sutras seem to flaunt the negative connotation of the word emptiness. Contemplating this idea is meant to undermine the persistent tendency to reify things, to consider them more substantial, independent, and permanent than they could possibly be. In spite of the negative connotations of the word emptiness, however, it is important to recognize that emptiness defines how things exist, relationally and impermanently. And it is not, therefore, the assertion that things somehow do not exist at all. What does not exist is a fixed essence to anything, a center that always remains the same, a condition independent of all conditioning. Nothing, the sutras claim, possesses its own being in this sense. And yet, things exist just as they are. So there's two reasons for going into this and paying attention to this. The first was that this is an account of things that does seem to be true. When we do a lot of sitting and examining and investigating, we discover that, in fact, this does reflect the nature of reality. Even though it doesn't appear to be obvious, at some point when you really study it, it starts being clear that it's true. But the second reason is that a world of impermanence and interrelations implies the impossibility of a permanently true and comprehensive conception of things. So the authors of these sutras and the Buddhists who followed their teachings were most interested in transformation in the way that people relate to things in their daily lives. This is why we're talking about it as really an activity or a behavior. That is, Buddhist monks sought self-transformation above and beyond their search for a conceptual picture that corresponded to the way things really are. They sought a fundamental transformation in the way they lived their lives by means of awakening from unenlightening ideas, habits, and practice. So, in a way, this sounds very simple, but wrapping your head around it gets to be difficult. So I said in the little blurb I put in the e-bulletin that this is a difficult thing to talk about, and that all we can do really is kind of point to it. So that's kind of what I'm doing today. So one element in this transformation is the practice of non-attachment. That has been cultivated in Buddhism since the beginning. If wisdom is the insight that nothing has a fixed nature, and that all things are in process, that would suggest cultivating just enough detachment from things, ideas, and people to accept that they would all change and finally pass away. Wisdom meant letting go to some extent, releasing one's grip on what would inevitably pass away on its own. The Wisdom Sutras added to the tradition a concentrated reflection on the necessity of non-attachment to specifically Buddhist ideas. So even the concept of emptiness and non-attachment and all of the other things that we talk about in Buddhist practice, those are also emptiness, and they need to not be like grasped onto with a big grip. So the sutra says, if it occurs to the bodhisattva, the great being, that I train in perfect wisdom, I develop perfect wisdom, if he perceives thus, then he moves away from perfect wisdom. If the bodhisattva even perceives the perfection of wisdom, then he has fallen away from it. So if you seek a kind of wisdom that is unchanging, an eternal wisdom that exists in and of itself, something that just is what it is without reference to context, relations, and time, then you seek it unwisely. There's a dialogue in the Perfect Wisdom Sutra that between Buddha and his disciple Subhuti. And it gets to the point where Subhuti can only say in exasperation, is then enlightenment non-existent? Fearing this paradoxical conclusion and hoping to be given a straight and uplifting answer, Subhuti only gets from the Buddha the answer that he dreads. So it is, Subhuti, so it is, as you say, enlightenment also is non-existent. The concept of enlightenment that you hold up in your mind is just as empty as anything else. It takes the mental shape that it does, dependent on other elements of understanding in your mind, your culture, your historical epoch. When they change, so does enlightenment, and vice versa. Becoming dogmatically attached to your current vision of enlightenment, therefore, is unwise. It is just another way to be stuck in place, another form of fearful grasping for security. In another section of the sutra, the disciple Subhuti responds to the Buddha's claim that the perfection of wisdom is empty of the perfection of wisdom by proclaiming that this is perfectly pure, the perfectly pure demonstration of the perfection of wisdom. No one has demonstrated it, no one has received it, no one has realized it. And since no one has realized it, no one has therein gone to final nirvana. This is obviously very unusual spiritual discourse. Wherever practitioners want something solid and secure to stand on, the mental rug is pulled out from under their feet. No ultimate foundation is offered because this kind of spiritual training is intended more to raise transformative questions than to provide easy answers. Oh, what fun. So, the first cartoon I have up here is Garfield. And Garfield is standing there, I've got it all. And in the second panel, he's just standing there smiling. And in the third panel, he's going, although I'm not quite sure what it is. So, and that's kind of how it is. I've got everything, even though I don't exactly know what it is. So, this can be kind of scary. So, talks about frightening stuff. Let's see here. Yes. So, when you start recognizing this and seeing this, it's kind of like, well, now, wait a minute, then I don't know what I'm doing here, and I don't know who I am, and I don't know what's really true and what's happening. And so, how does this go? Well, anyway, so this is part of the difficulty of it that I was talking about. Wisdom is the ability to face the truth and not be unnerved or frightened. It is the capacity to be disillusioned, but not disheartened. It is the ability to consider the contingency and the groundlessness of all things, oneself included, and not turn away from that consideration in fear. Wisdom means setting aside illusions about oneself and the world, and being strengthened by that encounter with the truth. It entails willingness to avoid seeking the security of the unchanging, and to open oneself to a world of flux and complex relations. This includes, as the Vimalakirti Sutra puts it, overcoming the habit of clinging to an ultimate ground. Developing the capacity to see the relationality and temporality of all things and not wince or turn away from that vision requires the bodhisattva to engage in training. So most of us can't just sort of do this because we think that makes sense or it seems like a good idea. We kind of have to do some practicing with it. One dimension of the training in wisdom featured in these sutras is the willingness to probe dimensions of experience that we normally just assume without question. This is the capacity to ask real questions. This capacity seems to come to come from a place of doubt, where suddenly you sort of look around and go, wait, is that really true? I'm not sure that's true. So then you ask some real questions about what's going on here. Repeatedly, the sutras admonish those who fail to inquire, who want to be told rather than to think for themselves. So in one, the Buddha says, it is hard to gain confidence in the perfection of wisdom if one is unpracticed, not eager to learn, unwilling to ask questions. So we have practice, we have motivation to learn, and we have asking questions. To ask is to open oneself to the possibility of a change or deepening of mind, to put oneself into a posture from which far-reaching transformation may be irresistible. So the sutras stress that practitioners should ask questions and counter questions, take nothing as a basic fact, and persist in inquiry, not yielding to the conventional views that dominate most human minds. So this ability to just stay with the questions, this is one of the things we were just talking about, is staying with the question rather than immediately jumping to an answer, seems to be a very important part of this process. Then he talks a little bit about the role of language in this. We ask questions oftentimes, we want to start defining words and figuring out what's going on. And I often start my talks with an attempt at least to define the meaning of what I'm talking about, if only just to give us a sense of, we all kind of have a sense of what we're doing and have a similar concept of it. According to the Wisdom Sutras, one of the reasons that profound questioning is required is that the practice of inquiry brings us to an awareness of the role of language in our experience of the world. Language is, of course, a component of culture, and therefore is very dependent on a lot of things that are going on around us. It is just as empty as everything else. These sutras, along with other Buddhist texts, are extraordinary in the extent to which they have engaged in penetrating reflection on language. The Bodhisattva is pictured as understanding what few of us ever encounter, the connection between what we experience and our language about it. In teaching, therefore, Bodhisattvas show others where language is blocking rather than enabling insight. They realize that the language in which the perfection of wisdom is articulated can either prevent or evoke the dawning of insight. In order to call attention to the role of language in shaping human experience, one sutra has Savutti say, to call it perfection of wisdom, that is just giving it a name. And what that name corresponds to, that cannot be got at. In another place, a sutra says that bodhisattvas refer to the ideas in their minds as notions, agreed symbols, and convenient expressions, but not as the true nature of things. The Buddha is pictured as proclaiming, beings are supported on words and signs, based on imagination of that which is not. It is from these words and signs that the bodhisattva, when he courses in perfect wisdom, sets them free. Bodhisattvas realize, the texts claim, that the tendency to assume the solidity, the permanence, and the independence of things is grounded in the familiarity of language, all the ways language is largely invisible to us. The ability to stand back from language on occasion in order to understand its role in the constitution of experience provides greater flexibility and skill in daily practices. It is one factor enabling wisdom in life. These abilities to question, to see the effect of our language on our minds, are considered part of what Mahayana Buddhists called skillful or skill in means. Think of it as skillful means or upaya. Skill in handling the means through which awakening might occur is essential to the practice of the bodhisattva. This skill is closely linked to the perfection of wisdom. One sutra says, but the skill and means of the bodhisattvas should be known as having come forth from the perfection of wisdom. Another says, the bodhisattva should train himself in the skill and means contained in this perfection of wisdom. Skill comes forth from wisdom, and skill is contained in wisdom. Developing one is simultaneously cultivating the other. One cannot be skillful without a profound realization of the emptiness of all things, and one cannot realize the emptiness of all things without the development of skill and means. The link between them is so tight that the Vimalakirti Sutra says, wisdom not integrated with skillful means is bondage, but wisdom integrated with skillful means is liberation, and vice versa. So, then he switches to talking about how the perfection of wisdom interacts with the other perfections. And he does this by looking at generosity, which is the first one, this business about giving a gift. And he talks about the distinguishing between what they call a worldly perfection or an ordinary perfection and a supramundane perfection, which is a wise perfection. Two different levels on which the six perfections can be practiced. And of course, it's not quite as simple as just there's this and then there's this. There is a developmental thing that goes along and a little more gradual thing about the levels. So here's the ordinary one, or the worldly perfection of generosity. A worldly practice of perfection is a typical quest for human achievement. You undertake the effort in order to achieve something good for yourself, human excellence. You engage in generous acts, for example, in order to be a good person, one known for the quality of generosity and respected as a contributor to the common good. Describing this level of practice, the Wisdom Sutra says, the bodhisattva gives, and gives liberally. It occurs to him, I give, that one receives, this is the gift. I renounce all that I have without any niggardliness. I act as the Buddha commands. I practice the perfection of giving. Having made this gift into the common property of all beings, I dedicate it to the Supreme Enlightenment. Tied by three ties, he gives a gift. Which three? The notion of a self, the notion of others, and the notion of a gift. To give a gift tied by these three ties, that is called the worldly perfection of giving. By contrast, the supramundane perfection of giving is based on a full realization of emptiness and the nature of all things. Neither the giver nor the recipient nor the gift is conceived of as a separate independent entity, as permanent and fixed in what it is. So we talk about in our meal chant, we mentioned the emptiness of the three wheels. That's what this is. Giver, receiver, and gift is one way to talk about these three wheels. They're all connected and empty in that way. As a giver, you would sense your own dependence on a multitude of factors beyond your own efforts. You would know that you live only on the basis of vast gifts that brought you into being and that have sustained you throughout your life. Having emerged in the world from causes prior to your own choosing, you would understand that you are not a permanent, independent entity. You would realize there really is no self in the non-relational way that common sense assumes. You would know that while you may be able to activate this gift, it's not really yours to give. Things circulate in the world forever, taking this form now and endless other forms at other times. You would understand the quaint and limited sense in which there really is no ownership at all in life. You would also sense that while the recipient of your gift is very much in need, that fact is contingent on a whole array of conditions that might have been otherwise. The bodhisattva understands that people who come to be who and what they are in the larger context of influence, their identity is dependent on who their parents are, their friends, their teachers, what opportunities happened to come their way, what education was available to them, as well as the extent to which they were able to take responsibility for their own acts and determine their own future. All of these structural elements in the act of giving are empty in that sense. They are all dependent on multiple factors, subject to change at all time, and therefore have no fixed evidence or essence upon which a permanently established picture of giving could be based. Here's how the Wisdom Sutra puts it. The supramundane perfection of giving, on the other hand, consists in the threefold purity. Here a bodhisattva gives a gift, and he does not apprehend a self, a recipient, or a gift, also no reward of his giving. He surrenders that gift to all beings, but does not apprehend those beings, or himself either. And although he dedicates that gift to the supreme enlightenment, he does not apprehend any enlightenment. This is called the supramundane perfection of giving. At the highest level of Mahayana Buddhist imagination, the bodhisattva is pictured as so enveloped in this profound understanding of the emptiness of all things that none of this needs to be conceptually articulated. The bodhisattva just sees things as they are and acts accordingly without needing to plan or scheme. This happens. Let me just see where I'm at here. So there's the example of the two different kinds of perfection. Now, as I mentioned before, this sort of develops as a over time from one thing to another. It's not sort of an immediate thing. It begins with faith, an instinct, perhaps a willingness to try, to engage with practice and be willing to transform. So many of us, when we start out, don't have any idea what we're doing here. I mean, I certainly didn't. I mean, I thought I did, but really, when I look back on it, it was like, well, okay, there was a little something there that was wanting to go in this direction that had kind of an instinct, there was something there, but I couldn't have described what it was. I'm not sure I could still describe what it is exactly. And one of the things that's pointed out, this is what he says: when seen as an ethical movement from unenlightened forms of life to more enlightened forms, these practices assume a gradual unfolding of wisdom through a multitude of levels that are not imaginable from the perspective of the point of departure. So that's what I mean when I say we really don't know exactly what we're getting into when we come in here. And I think that's true for most of us. Wisdom entails overcoming the isolation of the self, not just for the self, but on behalf of a larger collective reality beyond the self. It imagines stages of self-cultivation where self-concern is no longer the focal point of the activity, where doing what is right, doing the good on behalf of all members of the community, are the images of perfection. And at this stage, there's very little point in calling it self-cultivation, because all attention is now focused on a set of concerns that go far beyond the individual. So it takes us a while to get beyond the self-cultivation part of it. And I think one of the things that still sometimes seems so paradoxical to me is that in order to get to that place of really being able to see everything around me as a part of me and as just something that I'm interacting with, and that my giving is not, doesn't have anything to do with me or the other person or whatever it is that I'm giving. It really is just, it's just what's happening. That takes a while, and you don't get there without spending a lot of time on yourself. At least I couldn't get there without spending a lot of time on myself. So I just wanted to mention again, I think I've probably talked about this before, is this notion of faith, which is not the same as believing in something. It's not knowing. It is a willingness, a kind of curiosity, to try something, to engage with something, with kind of an instinct that maybe there's something there that could be useful. This is his summary, and of course I'm picking and choosing little pieces that make sense to me that I hope will also make sense to you, of sort of the early texts, the Wisdom Sutras, about this one. He then always, as he always does, he has a section that is sort of a critical contemporary look at this same teaching. And I wanted to share a little bit of that too with y'all. Okay. So the first one is ambiguity. Although it is tempting to envision a truly wise person as altogether exempt from ambiguity and limited vision, as earlier traditions have done, that would be a stage of omniscience, not wisdom. So omniscience means you know everything. And this is not what we're talking about. Accepting finitude, that is, our limitations, as the starting point for these meditations, we begin to come to wisdom not as the end of uncertainty, but rather as a capacity to face uncertain and ambiguous situations with integrity, composure, and reflective insight. Wisdom, therefore, will need to be reconceived as a quality of character that prepares us to function with fine-tuned ethical sensibility in changing contexts of extensive complexity and nuance while still acknowledging fallibility. So he talks about some things that make it difficult to kind of conceive of this, and one is that it is not rule-governed. It's not about following rules. Living wisely in a wide variety of situations requires skill at improvisation. It's not just knowledge. In fact, I was talking with someone today about how a lot of times what it requires is being willing to not know what's really going on. So it's not about knowledge, and it's not about rules. It's really more about... So authentic wisdom will also lead to the recognition that in most situations we really do not know at all. So the wise person is more attentive to learning than to knowing. So it's a process, and we begin to realize that it's a process of growth and knowing. And I wanted to just... So I'll do that and then I'll go on to this next thing. Those who are wise undergo a continual process of revision based on life experience. They expose themselves to situations where conceptual holdings are thrown into question and where fundamental reinterpretation of the world might be mandated. In this sense, wise learning is a form of suffering, something we live through at the cost of some disruption and discomfort. The counsel of wisdom, however, is not to avoid this disruption, but instead to seek out the transformative powers within it. Now, part of me just hates that. You know, I really like being comfortable. I really like having a sense that I know what's going on and I know what's going to happen next. But that's not wisdom. That's comfort. So I wanted to talk a little bit. He's got a paragraph in here about esoteric knowledge. And I thought this was useful because sometimes there's this sense of there's secrets, you know. And I had a person in prison ask me, why is it so taboo to somehow explain what enlightenment is? I was like, well, it's not exactly taboo. That's not really it. It's just difficult to describe. So one of the dominant images of wisdom in certain types of Buddhism is esoteric knowledge. This image is often given caricature as a secret knowledge that is withheld from the uninitiated in order to cultivate an atmosphere of mystery. But a better way to understand these secrets is to realize that wisdom and most forms of insights can only be entered and or received once you have undergone the preparatory cultivation of mind required to grasp them. Indeed, ascending to higher levels of understanding often requires a transformation of who you are as a knower. The so-called password allowing access to a deeper sense of reality is much more than a word or a mysterious sentence, a great mantra or whatever, or a thought. It is a complex alteration of the perspective from which you seek that depth. In Buddhism, that alteration or awakening typically arises dependent upon the mastery of meditation practices that function to change the way you experience things, yourself included. So recall that our translation of the Sanskrit word paramita, or perfection, implies transcendence, an act of going beyond. So it is an activity of perfecting. It's not something you arrive at and there you are. The activity of perfecting, the practice of being on the way towards greater vision, greater wisdom, this requires learning to be at home on the journey because there is nowhere else to be. He says, in fact, that wisdom in that view, cannot be separated from the pursuit of it. All right. I know this is going a little bit long, but I really wanted to put this little section in about, he talks about evolutionary biology and how that's really getting at this same concept that even types of beings keep changing over time. So this is where my second cartoon comes in. This is Red and Rover. And Red is this boy, and he's laying back on his dog, Rover, and he says, "Rover, you're so exceptionally soft and warm. What is your secret?" And Rover kind of looks at him, and he says, "No secret. I wasn't born an armadillo." And Red's eyes are wide open. He says, "Well, I guess that works for me." So this is just about, you know, in this particular moment, in this existence, I was born this way, okay? And this is how I sort of am now. But, you know, next lifetime, who knows? All bets are off. In a post-Darwinian culture, there are no biological essences, no timeless molds in which life forms are created. All forms of life come into being through mutations of earlier forms of life and then lose their current form through further mutations that incrementally alter each species over time. No outcome is determined or known in advance because all other forms and processes are similarly contingent and subject to unpredictable movement. Although aspects of these processes may be relatively stable, no form of life generated within them could ever be. To whatever extent that things have a nature, it turns out to be a temporary nature that is defined for them by the contextual conditions in which they have come to be what they are. So a lot of what we're doing, I'll try to just sum this up pretty quickly, is to find out, to start seeing clearly our position in which, in this entire scope of reality, in this whole of reality. And the way, one of the ways we do this is to pay attention to what's really true, to have this discipline of truth. And there's a lot more here that's really cool and fun, but I'm gonna end there and ask for comments and questions. Thank you. Actually, I just wanted to say one more thing, which is I really want to thank everybody for allowing me to do this. This has allowed me to get very quickly, very seriously and deeply into this material, and I have really enjoyed doing it. And I've been hearing from some people who have been enjoying this series as much as I have been, and so I just want to say thank you to those people. And if the rest of you are bored, oh, I'm so sorry. Comments and questions? Oh, we have a few. Okay.
Huh. So, you know, I have a wood stove at my house, and it has a glass door on it. And I build fires almost every day in the winter. And I usually, you can hear me?
I can hear you, but I'm having a little trouble understanding you, so I'm
all right, so yes, I'll try. Sure. And is that okay? Better?
That's better, yes.
All right. So fires in the fireplace, this wood stove, right, the glass door. And so I spend a lot of time being very unproductive and watching this fire.
Oh, yes. Heavens.
And more and more all the time, it seems. And nothing really exemplifies emptiness and impermanence for me more so than flames.
Yeah.
You know, and I found myself many times watching this fire and almost in a state of borderline panic as I realized just how there's absolutely nothing there.
Yeah.
And then that spreads outward, and it's not even a question of grasping and aversion anymore, because there is really nothing that you could grasp if you wanted to. And that just I'm not even sure why I feel the need to express this right now, but it is a truly frightening and uncomfortable experience that I've been having looking at that fire at times. Just absolutely, completely without anything to latch onto.
Yeah, you just can't hang on to it at all.
It just gone.
Yeah. I know that, you know, there's the story of Dogen at the age of 7 when his mother died, watching the incense, the smoke from the incense on the altar.
Yeah.
And having this, I think, probably a fairly similar realization of it's, you can't hang on to it, it just goes away, it's all impermanent. And it can be pretty frightening.
Yeah, it's funny because I took a chance and mentioned it to my wife about the flame. And she looked at me and she was like, well, it's just the way fire is.
That's also true. Oh, well. Right? I think behind you, too.
So you said that the key is encountering this not knowing,
mm-hmm.
and feeling not being afraid of it, I guess. Or right. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference in perspective between encountering it and experiencing fear and other responses that are not as skillful and a more skillful perspective.
Yeah, you could ask Daigai about that. I think when we start really seeing it, it can be very, very frightening. And so part of what has to happen, I think, is it's like any other fear. We just have to sit still and say, well, I guess I don't really know what's going on here. Okay, I still don't really know what's going on here, and just sort of noticing what does that feel like and how does it work, and so what does that mean? And I think it's a process. I don't know that there's a simple way to talk about what that is. Yeah. And I think too that it's not as though you get it and then you've got it. You know, we have our days. We all have our days. So
thank you.
One of the differences that is sometimes hard to tease out in this conversation is between de-reification and global skepticism or relativism.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between saying that the map is not the territory and saying that any map you provide might be accurate, might be the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I had a physician tell me about vision, about, you know, sort of training your eyes to work better, that one of the big problems is that people, you know, when they look at something, they at some point they stop actually seeing
it, yes.
And
yes.
Because you're seeing the model of it. And so
right.
Being able, the reason I like the word de-reification is it's a verb, not a noun, like emptiness is.
Right.
There's a process.
Right.
Can
yes.
I re-engage? Not that I'm going to look at an apple and I'm going to see an orange, but mm-hmm. that I'm going to see more.
You're seeing your idea of an apple, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that we do that a lot, and not just with vision, but all of our other senses and with our minds in terms of how we think the world is. So, which is one of the reasons he's talking about language in there, too, is because we kind of have this sense of, okay, this is how it all goes because we have this language and we've always talked about it this way. And everybody, of course, everybody's seeing the same thing, right? When they look at the color red, who knows? So the ability to just sort of stop and see what's actually there and notice what's going on in the mind to come up with a concept of that is, that's part of this, seeing through it, I think.
Thanks.
Genko, thank you for your talk and for your series of talks. I haven't heard all of them, but maybe I'll go back on the recordings and listen online. this one this morning was particularly, well, you know, this often happens where you have an event happen prior the week and then you come to Dharma Talk and it's like, that's exactly what I needed to hear, right?
That's good.
It's like reading your horoscope. Like, oh, yeah, that's me. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that's me.
Yes. Okay.
So I just got back from a vacation, and I was just all happy being in Tucson, Arizona, connecting with the native people there, feeling all joyous and, you know, just, you know, content. And I come home, and a girlfriend of mine yesterday tells me, well, you abandoned me and you left me and I thought we were a sangha and blah, 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 blah. And she's like, and then she wanted to engage that I wasn't enlightened and that she's nobody is. And she got into this argument with me about who was enlightened and who wasn't. And I got hooked. I was like, oh, okay, let's have this intellectual discussion about enlightenment. And it was just, now I look at it and I just think it's so funny how I just thought I had this with skillful means and wisdom as we were talking, and I realized, like, it was just a lot of silly ego me on my part. I don't know what's going on for her. But as I was listening to you talk, I was just thinking, like, how ungraceful it actually was on my part and how I actually could have just sat and listened and not been hooked with the argument about enlightenment. But it also, it was what it was. You know, I did say, right. Well, I just think we both have Buddha nature and we could leave it at that.
Right.
So it's always interesting, that talk.
It's one of those things that you could agree with either point of view if you really think about it. Yep, it's true. There's no enlightenment. Or what do you mean? We're all enlightened. I mean, they're both true, right? So what's the argument? But we do. We get into these and trying to, you know, pick things apart. And I don't know why we do that, but we seem to do that a lot. Got Shoke over here.
So this talk reminded me about the first time I walked into Dharmarain. And I came from Southern California where I was practicing every Tuesday. So I walked in on a Tuesday morning. And the very first person when I walked in through the door was you. And you're there and you're telling me, do you know what you're doing?
Oh, my.
Wow. I go, I sat before we're sitting. And my reaction was, yes, I'm here to sit. And after 8 years, it's, no, not really. But when do we sit? So.
That's great.
Something clicked for me about the giver, receiver, and gift in there. I don't know if I can articulate it, but this, and also that you said this is not knowledge that we can find, or it's the wisdom. However, that seeking helps went for you to recognize, oh, those were those pointers pointing to this. Mm-hmm. But with the receiver, giver, receiver, and gift, we are not separate. And so this gift between us, this space between us, that's how we come into being each moment. And that gift we give, we want that to be a gift or an anti-gift. And it's the self-protection that keeps us separate from
right.
the gift and mm-hmm. the other.
Yeah, there is that sense that we are a self, that we are like a person separate from everybody else. And so when that feels threatened, we kind of get, you know, we think, oh, well, I have to do something about that. And this is just pulling all of that out of there and saying, no, we're all just part of the same deal. Okay, so maybe Eric. No, not Eric. How about Daicho?
Thank you for your talk. When you said something about experience and language, mm-hmm. and I was just thinking about it yesterday, mm-hmm. and it occurred to me that it's not that simple at all, the connection between the experience and
what was that?
Connection between the experience and whatever words come out of that.
Right.
And there's a lot of lots and lots of amazing expressions that are impressive, but it really comes down to how I express my experience. Then it's they are all like shoes that don't quite fit.
Uh-huh.
And so what you said reminded me that, oh, not really trying to, because I used to try to find like a right size shoes by reading a lot of books.
Right.
And now I'm trying to, you know, like keep a journal, try to do it every day so that I can come up with my own expression, which is sort of working but not quite. And but I just gave me the sense of what you said, gave me the sense of like importance of patience.
Yes.
That.
Yeah.
Because at least I'm not, you know, I write down something and I'm not like immediately feel disgusted. It's more like, okay, this is how I come up with today at this moment, and does this really connect to my experience? Well, maybe not, but you know, I'll go
sort
to.
It's sort of similar, and points in that
I'm
direction.
In the stage of sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
Which actually is much better than it used to be. So,
right.
Just thank you for this reminding me of.
It does seem to be the nature of language that it's not gonna really. It's not going to nail it. You know, we want it to just be perfectly, this is it. And it just doesn't seem to work that way. And when you read translations of things, and especially like we read more than one translation of Dogen, for example, some of those sound really, really different from each other. And you're kind of going, well, which one is it? And probably neither one really gets to it, right? So, and the other thing about it is that when you come from a different culture, which all of us, in fact, have different cultures, if you really start thinking about it, but when you change cultures by moving to someplace else, you have to sort of start over again with, how are these people using language? I moved to a place when I was in high school, and they were all into this kind of ironic way of talking, which I had never encountered before. Like, you know, well, that'd be a lot of fun, which meant just the opposite. Things like that. And I was kind of, it took me a while to kind of get what they were doing. And we run up against this stuff all the time about, well, how are different people using language, and what are our assumptions about what it even means and how we're doing it? And it's useful to kind of pay attention to that. I've found it very interesting to look at language and to recognize its limitations in terms of expressing what's really true.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a phase for me too that where when I try to sound about right in a particular crowd, and then there's a phase when I'm next trying to say whatever, you know, based on my experience, and just go back and forth.
Yeah. I went through a period of time where I found myself stuttering, which I haven't stuttered in my life particularly, but at one point in time, I started saying something and then I stopped because I realized, well, the opposite is also true, which is very frustrating, right? It's kind of like, okay, then what can I say, really? And at some point, you know, it's like what Katagiri Roshi says in the title of his second book, which is, you have to say something. So,
yeah.
Do our best.
Yeah.
No Dharma school today. Oh, I'm sorry. I was kind of waiting for all the kids. Oh, it's 11:30. My goodness. Okay. Thank you very much for your kind attention.